The federal government has overseen public housing in East St. Louis for more than 30 years. Last month, HUD Secretary Ben Carson handed that authority back to the city.
And HUD is not abandoning you, but rather trusting and partnering with you to enhance the quality of life for all our citizens.
That audio is from City of Champions Broadcasting. Today, we'll look at living conditions for residents like Renika Simmons.
But sometimes they don't even come out and fix it. My bathroom, toilet, the back of it, the thing coming off there, my bathroom door, the hinge coming off the wall.
Also, the U of I is leading a project that hopes to bring the Internet of Things to the battlefield. And can the Cubs dig themselves out of a 2-0 hole against the Dodgers? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Ben Carson, the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development, has come to Illinois twice in the last 2 months. In August, he visited Cairo and was met with local residents who were frustrated that two public housing complexes were being torn down. Late last month, he stopped by East St. Louis, and the mood was a little more celebratory. Secretary Carson formally handed over control of a housing agency in East St. Louis from the federal to the local level. That's after 32 years. HUD and the city of East St. Louis decided it was time for the city to start running its housing agency again. This is the first and longest span of time that the federal government has had over a local housing authority. All of this comes at a time when East St. Louis itself has been shrinking over the past few decades. In the 1950s, East St. Louis was actually the fifth largest city in Illinois with more than 80,000 people. Today, its population is just under 27,000. We're going to be speaking with the director of the East St. Louis Housing Authority in a few minutes. But first, I'm joined on the line by Renika Simmons. She's a resident of East St. Louis, and she lives in the Norman E. Owens Public Housing Complex. Hi, Renika. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Renika, I understand that you've been living in some pretty difficult conditions right now in the housing complex. I wonder if you can give us a sense of, as far as housing goes, what's the biggest worry that you have on a day-to-day basis?
I have two little girls, and also I am raising my two little sisters, and the crime rate is very high. I'd be sometimes scared to let them go outside because of what be going on. Fighting, shooting at random times, daytime.
So the crime outside is a big concern. What about inside in terms of housing? What are your conditions like? Do you think they're satisfactory?
No. Some things are, but some things are not. Like, things that need to be fixed, they don't come fixed. We have to wait months on top of months before they do come out and fix, even though we put in work orders, which they tell us to call and put in work orders. But when we do, we never see anybody.
Well, like, what kind of things need to be fixed, Renika?
Paint peeling off the walls, which I don't think that's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
My hinges on the doors breaking, cabinets breaking. They come out and exterminate now once every month on a Wednesday. But, I mean, they really don't do as much, and they tell us don't spray anything that we buy on top of what they spray. But the rodents still come and go. They still come in.
So do you have a big rodent problem? Is this, I don't know if it's mice or rats, inside your apartment?
Mice. I mean, yeah, mice.
Yeah, and how old are your kids, Renika?
I have a 6-month-year-old, and I also have a 3-year-old.
And your two little sisters?
4 and 5.
Are 4 and 5. So you're taking care of 4 kids under the age of 5. How much are you worried about the rodent situation and that cleanliness and all of that around such young children?
I really think it's pathetic, but I personally try to take care of the situation by buying certain things that I think can get rid of it, but we have neighbors, and neighbors are nasty, so what they have come over to the next apartment, and it's just back and forth, back and forth.
Is East St. Louis a place you'd want to stay, Renika? I know you were a big track and field and cross-country runner back in high school. I know that's something that we know about you, and I wonder sort of where you want to be in life.
It's actually not a place that I want my kids to grow up in. I really want them to grow up in a different environment from what I grew up in, because I was born and raised in East St. Louis, and I'm still here, obviously. But I'm trying my hardest to get out. I do want to go back to school, but with me having my two little sisters, it's kind of hard for me to have a support system as far as somebody keeping them while I go off, or like finding a babysitter.
Right, right, because we're talking about four little girls, five and under, right? Yeah. Renika, we're actually about to talk to the director of the Housing Authority. Is there anything you want her to know?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yeah, we're about to speak with the director of the East St. Louis Housing Authority. Is there anything you'd like her to know, or anything you would could ask her if you could?
Basically, I mean, they can do better. We working hard trying to make money just to pay the rent and the electric bill that is being provided from at the where we stay at, and we're not getting the attention that we need from them to make our living, to make our home more stable for us to stay,
mm-hmm.
and for our kids.
Renika, like thinks, that they, yeah, go ahead.
It's like they, I mean, they really don't care. For real.
Renika, thanks for that. I appreciate you taking the time. Renika Simmons is a resident of East St. Louis, living in the Norman E. Owens Public Housing Complex. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. As I was saying, the executive director of the East St. Louis Housing Authority is Mildred Motley. She's been with us as well, listening into this conversation. Hi, Mildred. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Mildred, I'm sure that it must be frustrating for you to hear residents like Renika, who express concerns, saying that she thinks that the Housing Authority doesn't care, and talking about the conditions that she has to live under. What are you doing to address those concerns of residents like Renika? And I wonder what you do when people, when you hear residents say, well, they don't even care about the conditions we're living in.
Yes, it is very distressful to hear that the residents think we don't care, because that's totally contrary to my position. We're there to provide a service to the residents. Without the residents, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be needed. And it's important that not only do we provide good, safe, and decent housing, but that we treat the residents as we want to be treated. So we definitely do care. We are attempting to address the issues that the residents face on a daily basis. But, you know, one of the things that the reality is that we don't have enough money to totally do everything we need to do. So we do have to make decisions about what's the priority. Her basic concerns with respect to safety and maintenance are probably concerns that are expressed by a lot of residents. We do have a public safety force. They are 24 hours a day, but they can't be everywhere, and we don't have them stationed at each site. Unfortunately, we do have crime that happens outside our developments, but it impacts our residents just as well. So we are trying to address those issues as they are brought to us. We literally just had a meeting at her site last week. We're having meetings at the resident at each development so that the residents can express to us what's going on. What do they need? What do they need from us so that we are as responsive as possible?
And Mildred, yeah, you mentioned sites. I wonder if you can give us a sense of the different types of public housing that comes under the purview of the East St. Louis Housing Authority. We talked about the Norman E. Owens Public Housing Complex. How big is that? And how many other sites are there like that?
There are we have quite a few sites that are like Normani Owens as far as size and makeup.
And are those high-rises then? Those are high-rises?
No, Normani Owens is not a high-rise. Normani Owens is a series of townhomes. We also have six high-rises. We have some scattered sites, which are a combination of single-family homes and townhouses. We have developments spread out throughout the city, and all of our properties are located in the city of East St. Louis.
And so that's different than, for example, from the Section 8 program, correct? So people
correct.
Who are getting Section 8 housing vouchers, that's a different program than, and that's not under your authority.
No, we no longer have a Section 8 program. Ours are all public housing, which means that we own and manage all of our public housing. The development, Normani Owens, is one that was contracted out for management, but as of August 18th, I believe, we brought it back in-house so that we are now officially managing all of our properties ourselves so that we can try to get a better control over what is needed by our residents. But each development varies in size depending on which one. We have anywhere from 200 units at a particular development to some of the smaller scattered sites are 20 and 30 in size. So we have them across the gambit.
And is it about 2,000 people, am I correct, that you're, or you have about, I'm sorry, is it about 6,000 people you have living in about 2,000 units under the purview?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
We have approximately 2,039 public housing units. And my guesstimate is I'd say about 6,000 residents, give or take, because of the various sizes of the apartments that we manage.
So as we said earlier, HUD Secretary Carson was in St. Louis, in East St. Louis, to formally hand over the management of public housing from the federal government to local authorities. This was the longest time the federal government had ever overseen a local housing authority. You said money was an issue, and I want to get to money in a minute, but I wonder if I could ask what you wish HUD had done more of while it was in charge of the public housing complexes. What have you been left with that are your biggest challenges right now?
Well, our biggest challenges are that our developments are older and they're not the best housing stock. Our oldest development is was built in 1943, and a lot of the developments need substantial work. We are currently evaluating what we have and making a decision whether or not we're going to keep the existing housing stock or rehab it or demolish it and rebuild. We're literally evaluating every development that we own. So our biggest challenge is going to be having enough dollars to make an impact on our existing housing portfolio.
To the dollars point, I know when Secretary Carson was in town, he said that millions of dollars were going to be coming to East St. Louis. I understand that number is actually closer to, there was some clarification after he spoke, and it's actually closer to $1.9 million that you're expected to have as a grant. May I first ask, when do you expect to get those funds?
That's not the exact nature of the funds. We already have
Those you have. Okay.
We already have.
That you have.
That's not any new money coming. And what we're doing now, that is money that we have. We get, once we tear down developments or units, we get what's called replacement housing factor funds. And that's where this source of funds is from. And so now we are looking at what site we want to address. We can't use it on existing public housing, so we're either going to buy a property and rehab it, or will you build on vacant property so there would be new construction. That we hadn't finalized our plan for that as of yet, but it's not new
okay.
money that we already have.
And so to the money point, are you in need of millions, as Secretary Carson said? Is that something that would be available for you all to apply for?
We are in need of millions. Whether or not it's available, I can't tell you that. I think that there are different programs that we can apply for funding, and we have actually applied for a Choice Neighborhood planning grant for the Gompers development, which is our oldest development, Gompers Homes. But there's not as if there's just one single pot that we can say, Secretary, we need $100 million right as a check. There's nothing of that nature. So we have to literally apply for the same pots of money that all the other housing authorities across the country are applying for.
And I also was curious, when you said that you were building new housing, then the idea is then people wouldn't be relocated, because I know that's been such an issue in Caro, the idea of relocation of residents. Is that something you all are considering?
No. If they're relocated, they'd be relocated to whatever new housing that we develop. I would not say they need to be relocated out of East St. Louis. No, that is not something that we're considering.
Okay. And, you know, we just have really just less than a minute left, but just wanted to ask you about what you want elected officials statewide to know about housing in East St. Louis, whether that's Governor Rauner or other folks.
The main thing I want people to know about us is that even though we, our population, our low income, we are still a part of this community, and when consideration is being made for economic opportunities and housing, that they should consider us as well. Even though we're transferred to local control, I think people misconstrue that, and they believe that that means we're not a city agency. We are not a city agency. We are a separate municipal entity, and we are governed by a board of commissioners that's appointed by the mayor with approval of the city council. So we're still another business, just as if you were considered a private developer or someone else in the community.
We've got to take a break, but I'll let you finish that thought on the other side of this, if you don't mind sticking around with us for a minute. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. We'll continue this conversation just after this break. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about public housing in East St. Louis. After more than three decades of federal management of their housing facilities, it's been handed back to local control. We were just talking with one of the residents in some public housing in East St. Louis, Renika Simmons, along with the director of the East St. Louis Housing Authority, Mildred Motley. Mildred, I just wanted you to finish that thought. You were talking about what you want people to understand about what your role is as a local housing authority. I just wanted to give you a chance to finish that thought.
Okay. Basically, even though we service low-income residents, I think it's important for our residents to be included in the community because they are a part of the community. And I think that's the biggest thing that people overlook. It's kind of looked at, well, that's just the housing authority's issue. But it's not. We are all part of this community, and we need to be embraced and thought of and considered during any and all planning activities as to what should happen in a neighborhood, because we are within those neighborhoods. So it's just being open-minded and realizing that public housing residents are still residents of East St. Louis, Illinois, and St. Clair County in the state of Illinois, mm-hmm. and that they have the same hopes and dreams as someone else who just happens to have more income and can make those dreams happen quicker.
Do you think you get a sense that other elected officials in the East St. Louis area understand that and consider you part of the conversation in the community?
Yes, I think they do. I've been here just over 2 years, and we have definitely developed a good rapport with the city, and we are at the table in the community planning. I consider my fate tied to the city's fate and their fate tied to my fate, because without economic development, it's going to impact my residents negatively. And without decent and safe housing, it will impact the city negatively. So I do think that we are now at the table and being considered, yes.
Last question for you. We started this conversation with you talking about priorities, and you talked about public safety. What are your other priorities going forward? I know there's been a lot of conversation about public-private partnerships to develop new buildings.
Yes, that is a priority. As I said, most of our developments are old and outdated, and so the priority is to make good decisions about what developments are viable, which ones are not, and how to proceed to provide more stable housing and a good product for our residents.
That's Mildred Motley. She's the director of the East St. Louis Housing Authority. Mildred, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Joining us on the line now is Molly Parker. She's a reporter with the Southern Illinois, and she wrote this deep dive about this whole issue that actually inspired our segment. We'll tweet out the link right now. If you follow 21ST Show, we'll have it at our website at 21stshow.org to her Southern article. Hi, Molly. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
Yeah, Molly, you've been listening to this conversation that we've been having first with Renika and also now with Mildred. I wonder what stands out for you when you think about East St. Louis and the challenges that their housing authority is facing right now?
Well, I did listen to both ladies speak, and two very inspirational people. One housing resident, of course, trying to make a better way for her family than the one that she had. Tough to hear some of those things. Tough to hear her say that, you know, feels like people don't care, though it's very understandable. But I'm sure if you're sitting in Ms. Motley's position, it's again, hard to hear those things because I don't know her well, but you can just tell just hearing her talk, watching her, that she is someone who does care. I wrote in that story, it's just a big challenge that even the most gifted leaders will struggle to get through. East St. Louis, like many of our downstate communities, faces a series of challenges. East St. Louis presents themselves in particular ways with the crime issue, and that is obviously one thing it faces in abundance that some of our downstate communities may not have as big of a problem with, but this idea of sort of disinvestment and of economic challenges, it's widespread from I-64 South. We're really, really struggling and seeing a hard time here. So when they talk about that public-private partnership and needing economic development, that couldn't be more true. You know, the thing we all need is jobs, and they say jobs drive housing, but we're having a really hard time in this economic climate. Issues going on at the national level, issues going on at the state level, rebounding our economies.
And so when we think about what does that mean when you say a public-private partnership? I think we always hear elected officials talk about this, right, Molly? And especially when it comes to issues like public housing, people say public-private partnerships are the answer. What do they mean when they say that?
I think there's a number of different options for that, and by no means am I an expert. I know the State Housing Development Authority recently, for instance, released the federal tax credit program announcements. We noted this year there's one round of those. There was none issued south of 64. So those federal tax credits are something that private developers tap into to help build low-income housing. There are a number of HUD programs that work through these partnerships where they pair, as I understand it, like Section 8 vouchers to private developments to help support the funding. They support mixed income. So, you know, you're encouraged to have a development where you're renting at different levels, some of them subsidized by the federal government, some of them not, people paying at different price points. And it's a great concept. It really is. And it makes sense. It's just, I think that the challenge that you're seeing, and when I've recently been inundated with this issue down in Carroll, but I've branched out and talked to other local developers local housing authority managers, and they'll tell you that the challenge is in some of our rural regions, it is difficult to get to attract those developers at the rate you need to. In Carroll, they can't attract a private developer at all. And in some other areas they can, but not at the rate that they need to, like she's talking about in East St. Louis, to replace the vast amount of aging housing complexes. So I think that it's, a good concept and something that works in theory and works in areas where the economy is taking off, but we're seeing these challenges where all of Illinois is experiencing people moving out, certainly Southern Illinois, and I would say that, south of I-64 is really struggling with economic challenges that make these things more and more difficult as the housing stock continues to get older and older and older.
You know, one observation that you make in your article is that there's a lot of confidence in the new mayor, Jackson Hicks, that she can help turn things around. I wonder what it was like to be with Secretary Carson in East St. Louis celebrating the fact that HUD is handing over management of public housing to local authorities. From your perspective, was this a moment where the local housing authorities were excited about taking everything over and feeling like this is a moment we can do this now?
I mean, look, I was there for a brief celebration, and you know how these things go when you have a dignitary in town. There's a certain amount of pomp and circumstances there. Certainly, you know, it was a upbeat celebration. But when I spoke to the housing authority director afterward, you know, she is a very upbeat person, and I think she's optimistic. I think you have to be optimistic about the challenges you face. I mean, what is the alternative? But I think that, you know, I would have liked to have heard a little bit more of addressing from Secretary Carson the very real issues that they're facing in East St. Louis and throughout the 12th Congressional District. East St. Louis is, you know, a little outside of our coverage area, but we share news content a lot with the Belleville News Democrat. They picked up that story as well. You know, this is all the 12th Congressional District, East St. Louis to Cairo. Now, those two are getting a lot of attention right now because HUD has been involved in both of those. Secretary Carson came to visit both of those. But I can tell you there are several other housing authorities in the 12th Congressional District that are also sitting on sort of a bubble, sitting on a crisis waiting to happen, if you will.
Yeah, Molly, when you say that, when you say a crisis waiting to happen, because you're right, Cairo and now East St. Louis are getting a lot of attention because of the federal because of the visits by Secretary Carson, what is the crisis? Is it how old this housing stock is? Is it the lack of funding? Is it all of these things?
It's all of the above, and I think you're just hitting the nail on the head there. It's all of those things. And in some cases, it's mismanagement on top of those things. Of course, not, you know, this new leadership in East St. Louis has been congratulated and hailed as being, you know, above corruption and all those things. And it, by all signs, that appears to be the case. But, you know, there's a long history of corruption, government mismanagement in places like East St. Louis and Cairo. But again, those, it's not entirely fair because they get the most attention. Some of the things that have happened there in the past were quite egregious. But you see that throughout. Let's say it's not corruption. Let's call it mismanagement in some cases, or just lack of know-how. We have all of, down here, we have countywide housing authorities almost exclusively. A few cities, Mount Vernon City and Marion, have housing authorities. So we have each of these rural counties with their own housing authority. They're not really watched. Some of them do a really, really good job, and others do not quite as well. And I think some of that has to do with even mismanagement probably isn't fair. I think maybe know-how, expertise, and that also weighs into the situation. And then the more challenges you throw on top of that, the more economic challenges you have, the more extreme the problem is that you face.
What does this whole situation tell you about the larger issue of the disconnect between southern and southwestern Illinois and other parts of the state? Obviously, we think of Chicago's public housing gets a lot of attention, gets a lot of media attention, there's a lot of journalists covering that issue. It probably even gets more national attention, obviously, than southern and southwestern Illinois.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Mildred said it's important to recognize that the residents who live in public housing, while they're low income, are as much a part of our communities and as a part of our state as anyone else. And I actually am encouraged by the debate, by the conversation and attention that we're receiving on East St. Louis and Cairo. And our newspaper's intention will be to elevate that conversation to look at other, you know, whether they're urban or rural, in the case of East St. Louis and Cairo respectively, but they're smaller and they're more isolated, they get less attention. And so I think having these conversations in a midterm election is extremely positive. Look, HUD over the years has not been able to solve the problems in East St. Louis. We've seen that, and it's not just
this. It's not just East St. Louis, right? I mean, yeah, this is a problem we talk about.
It's right.
Right. This is challenges that are being faced all across the country and not just in Illinois. But mentioning election year, one last quick question for you, Molly. You asked Governor Rauner about this, how he tackled this issue. You talked to Senator Dick Durbin about this. What are elected officials saying about how they feel like they should be helping the situation?
Well, it's really, really frustrating to hear politicians say they don't have answers. And you can say, in East St. Louis specifically, you can't say that we lacked political clout. I mean, U.S. Senator Durbin sits on the Appropriations Committee. He holds a powerful position as, you know, a whip right now in the Senate. He was close friends with Barack Obama. We had a president from Illinois who would have been in East St. Louis, who had been in Cairo. And so you can't say it's not political clout, and you can't blame it on this current administration. All I can tell you is that I'm encouraged by the fact that, at least in Southern Illinois, in a way I haven't heard in recent years, we are talking about these issues. Governor Rauner basically told us in the editorial board, sorry, you know, it's really, really sad what's happening in Cairo, but I don't have any answers. My attempts to reach out to him and his administration at IDA have been unsuccessful. I mean, they continue to call us for other things, but I think they know that these are real issues, but that there are not any answers. But just because there are not easy answers doesn't mean that we shouldn't and that we must continue the conversation on these issues.
Molly Parker on the line from Carbondale from the Southern's newsroom. Molly, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for joining us to provide a little bit more context about this situation. We appreciate it.
Thanks for giving us some time. We appreciate it.
World Series champions, the Chicago Cubs, are home back in Chicago in Wrigley Field tonight, down 2 games to the LA Dodgers. This was a pretty tough loss to watch on Sunday night, capped off by a walk-off home run by the Dodgers' third baseman, Justin Turner. We've got righty Kyle Hendricks on the mound for the Cubs tonight. Joining us for a quick sports update is WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Reisout. Hey, Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st and back to Illinois. You've been flying back and forth here.
Yeah, I came back last night from L.A.
What do the Cubs and Kyle Hendricks and Joe Maddon need to do to turn the series around tonight?
Well, Kyle Hendricks has to go several innings. He can't go 4 or 5. They would love for him to get into 6th, 7th, and maybe even beyond that, but at least 6 or 7 is what they need out of him. But they also have to get some hitting out of their two big guns. Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant have been handcuffed in this series, and so they have to get going. If they don't do that, the concern is also is the bullpen has been shaky at times. Actually, in that game Sunday night, the bullpen pitched well until John Lackey gave up that home run, and John Lackey's a reliever. I mean, a starter, not a reliever. So it was one of those mixed bag games as far as the outcome, but they also have to keep Turner off the bases.
Cheryl, I mean, this has been a tough series to watch so far, and I also have to say the games have been really long. I want to get to that in a second, but let's just start with Joe Maddon, the manager of the Cubs, ejected from the game. Was that Saturday night, right, that he was ejected?
Yes.
He's actually been the target of a lot of scathing social media criticism. The way, as you said, he's handling the bullpen and what pitchers are going in. What do you think about how the managing decisions he's made so far?
Well, there's a couple of issues on that. Sometimes it's the personnel. The personnel may not be there. It's sometimes, you know, he's going by his gut. Sometimes he's going by, you know, what he sees as far as righties, lefties, trying to do the right thing. The problem is that when you are in the microscope, the microscope is on you like it is right now. Anything he makes, if he makes a decision that the public feels is wrong, he's going to get chastised.
Well, and of course, because they're losing, right? So they're all bad decisions,
exactly.
Right, when you're losing the game.
Exactly. Because last year, a lot of people had questions about how he used Aroldis Chapman. But they won, so that went underneath the table. Nobody, you know, remembers that as much. But now that talk comes back from last year, coupled with this year. He won
right.
The World Series champion.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up with Cheryl real quick. Cheryl, if you can stick around for a minute or two. I know you're at Bulls practice, which is probably another question we should get to. If you can just stick around for a minute, I'd appreciate it. Stay tuned. We'll continue this on the other side of this short break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking sports for a minute. Big game tonight for the Cubs in the National League Championship Series against the Dodgers. We're down 2-0. WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Roy Stout is with us. Cheryl, do you think there's a sense of panic in the Cubs clubhouse from what you've been seeing and hearing?
No, you know, because they've been in this situation before and they've been resilient about it, but it is a different time. I look at the L.A. Dodgers as being just a tremendously talented team. Their bullpen has been unbelievable. This is a team that the Dodgers have not lost a game in the postseason yet. So it's not so much on the Cubs side. It's actually the face what they're facing. But the fact that they're at home, the fact that they last year when they played the Dodgers, they just needed one hit here, one hit there, and they're able to come back. That's what they have to be thinking right now. Other than that, the starting pitching for the Cubs has been outstanding this whole postseason. It's been the bullpen. You don't want to get into the bullpen if you don't have to, because that's their Achilles heel.
And can we just talk about how painfully long these games are? And I know the diehard Cubs fans out here, maybe they like the games being long. I do not. I was pretty cranky, I have to say, on Thursday evening, thinking, is this game ever going to end? I know the MLB has actually been talking about trying to keep game length down. Is there anything that can be done about that? And I imagine that makes the players exhausted, too.
Oh, it makes us crazy that cover the games, you know. There are a couple of things they can do. First off, they got to stop these mound visits so much by the catchers and just cut that down. They also have a clock that they had been running. They use in the minor leagues where they could get they got to get in the box when that time is up. They've got to start doing that because, you know, you're losing fans. The other thing, it doesn't help that TBS is having an 8 o'clock start Central Time tonight, which, you know, how many kids are going to be staying up watching it on the school night? They make mistakes because of the revenue that they want to get. But there are things, simple things in the game that they can do to curtail this. When I was in Washington, that game was a 9-inning game that was almost 5 hours long.
Oh, yeah.
It was an exciting game. Don't want to take that away from it. But it becomes very tedious when it's this long. And if you want to build history with families and their kids, you cannot have these long games, and you cannot have them this late on a weeknight.
I will make a joke. My dad was joking about cricket, and he was like, people say cricket is long, but I think these baseball games are long. So I will say that.
We look at each other in the press box going, are you kidding? I mean, even when after a game during regular season, Joe will come in, he'll look at the clock and goes, oh, boy, it's already 11 o'clock. Yes, Joe, it's 11 o'clock.
Quick question for you, one quick last question. Your Apples practice right now. NBA season officially kicks off today. What's your sense of optimism about the Bulls this year?
There is no optimism about the record. Their optimism is maybe they're building towards something. This is a rebuild year. You're going to see guys on this roster. You're going to go who, what, where, and are they going to be with the team in the future? They're aiming for that number one draft pick next June.
Oh, that's it. All right. So we'll look forward to next June is essentially what you're saying with the Chicago
yes.
Bulls. WBEZ Sports contributor Cheryl Roy Stout is seeking it out through all of these playoff games for us. We appreciate it. It's always great to talk to you, Cheryl. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Over the last decade or so, the internet has rapidly changed, evolving from email into a pervasive smart force that's inside everything. Your kitchen appliances, your thermostats, medicine, cars. That evolution, that shift in the internet's very purpose is often referred to as the Internet of Things, or IoT. And consumers and techies aren't the only ones that are interested in IoT. For years, the U.S. military has been experimenting with how it can reshape the battlefield. And earlier this month, the U of I announced it will lead a $25 million research initiative on military applications for the Internet of Things. Tarek Abdul-Zahir is a computer science professor at the University of Illinois. He's an academic lead on the initiative and in our Urbana studios now to tell us more about his research and the Internet of Battlefield Things. Tarek, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
So before we get into this initiative in details, I feel like people talk about the Internet of Things all the time. What would that mean? And I think people get a Nest, you know, like a thermostat that communicates with the internet, or scales that kind of can refer back. You step on a scale, it's connected to all of these other things. What would that mean on a battlefield?
Well, so if you imagine the Internet of Things, you can think of things like your home thermostat, temperature control systems, maybe home security systems. They would have sensors to detect intruders. They would have ways to call somebody for help. Well, on the battlefield, we also need services that would essentially enhance defense capabilities. These services would aim to put people out of harm's way. Why have people involved when machines can do it? Some of these services would be involved more with disaster response, for example. You are in a hurricane site. You're trying to look for survivors. You need to deploy the right sensing capabilities to understand where the survivors are, what they need. You need to deploy some kind of devices to be able to help them. The same applies in military defense situations as well. It's all about automation, interconnection, and making these machines able to collaborate and autonomously perform missions that in the past would need human involvement.
And so when we think about this, how do you envision, I wonder if you could give us some practical examples of, I know this is the beginning of this research, but how this could affect, say, some American soldiers on the field in terms of, would this be something where their armor and that all of their equipment would be connected? What's kind of an envisioning of how you would see this technology helping save military lives?
Absolutely. I mean, think of armor, think of the weapons themselves, the radios, think of the soldiers. They're all interconnected. They all form pieces of what you can think of as this huge transformer, if you've seen the movie. Except that it's not just the one machine. It's distributed and it's made out of thousands of little things. And you need to configure these things like a transformer into the right capability to perform the right type of mission. You need to figure out what type of senses does this transformer need, what type of muscle or brawn it needs to have, what type of brain. All of these would be digital components, weapons, radios that you put together to deliver the impact that you need for your mission.
Right. And that obviously, when we think about that, would maybe perhaps lead to not just saving more military, but also civilian lives?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Collateral damage today is one of the big problems. You know, you send a rocket that blows up something and maybe there are pedestrians who are civilians near the place. If weapons were smarter, we can absolutely reduce collateral damage like that. We can absolutely reduce civilian loss of life.
Tarek, you talked about transformers, and I think when people do think about this, we were talking this morning, the producers and I, about the military movie with Tom Cruise, The Edge of Tomorrow, or you think about, I think people think about Blade Runner, Minority Report, and how different police are equipped with technology. Those are kind of, when you think about Minority Report or Blade Runner, we think about sci-fi movies with the examples of intelligent technology that's gone wrong. Are there dangers or concerns associated with the type of research you're doing? What are you kind of doing to build in to sort of safeguard against those sorts of issues?
This is a really good question, and that's precisely why we need research. That's precisely why universities need to be involved. We are delivering the knowledge, the know-how, the capability to build these services in a way that is safe, so that all the ethical implications are worked through, all the possible vulnerabilities, all the possible ways things can go wrong. That's what we need to think about. That's what we need to avert with the research that's being done in this project.
So there's 6 universities on this. The University of Illinois is really taking the lead. Can you kind of share how the University of Illinois is taking the lead and what other universities you're working with?
Oh, absolutely. So there are 7 partners, 6 universities with Illinois in the lead. There is UCLA, USC, UMass, CMU, Berkeley. There is SRI International. And together, the team is about 20 people from different disciplines, different parts of computer science. Some are studying social science to understand ethical implications. Some are studying security implications and vulnerabilities. Some are studying control and autonomy. Some are studying artificial intelligence. together, I think we can put that knowledge to the benefit of these technologies so that when we build them, they are in fact safe, they do save lives, and they can be penetrated and used against us.
We're speaking with Tarek Abdel-Zahair. He's a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. What role is the U of I taking then? It makes sense that different universities are splitting up and tackling different pieces. What's going to be happening here in Illinois?
At Illinois, among other things, we're going to study the science of autonomy and control. You know, we need to build these distributed systems that are acting almost human in the sense that they have reflexes. If you put your hand on something that's really hot, you yank it back. A machine, a distributed machine like what we're building, needs to have those reflexes so that it can avoid danger. It needs to be able to think after it reflectively avoids danger. It needs to be able to think and plan ahead. This is artificial intelligence. We need to understand how to do it, how to enable it. So those are some of the capabilities, I guess, that we'll be working on at the University of Illinois.
And obviously, this is sort of a different kind of thing when we think about the technology we use in civilian life, like an Amazon Echo, which we don't have to worry about someone hacking or shooting at, right? So imagine there's a lot of challenges with this.
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the huge challenges is that you are not working in a benign environment. Like you said, you know, nobody's shooting at Amazon Echo, but we are in an environment in the battlefield where people are trying to disrupt communications. They're trying to break things down. They're trying to capture nodes, infiltrate them. And so robustness, resilience against damage, being able to recompose yourself and continue the mission when you have suffered loss and being able to do that safely and still deliver the result, these are some of the challenges that need to be dealt with.
So the Army Research Lab is funding this potentially decade-long initiative. You've locked in $25 million for the next 5 years with the opportunity to extend it. If everything's going well 5 years from now, what does success look like to you?
I think success would be to at least demonstrate in a test bed, and we do have a national test bed that we are going to build, that a proof of concept that shows this is a viable way forward. And in the project is indeed 10 years, so after that we have 5 more years to perhaps field it or take it to the next level.
So you're really hoping that within the next 5 years you'll have technology that's actually being used in military situations?
We will at least have prototypes that are able to demonstrate the concepts. I think adoption in military applications will need perhaps additional investments, in part because this research is meant to be public. Later, it may enter a next sphere where it's not public. But the beginning is to show the prototype, is the beginning is to demonstrate the capability to really understand whether this is possible or not. And, of course, we believe that it is.
Tarek Abdel-Zahair is a computer science professor at the University of Illinois. He's the academic lead for this Internet of Battlefield Things research initiative. Tarek, thank you for being with us and explaining a little bit more about this. It's fascinating technology that you're working on.
Oh, thank you very much for hosting me.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media. All of that is at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, if you search for 21stshow, that's our handle. During the program, we live tweet with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, you like the 21st. That way you can also interact with us, comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Alan Montecilio, Bob Holly, and Robin Lynn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks also to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from downtown Chicago in the Medill Graduate School of Journalism at Northwestern University. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.